Oxide Radio, Oxford University's only student-run radio station.
Hello and welcome to Oxide Radio. This is Theo Davis-Lewis on Oxford Today. Last week we spoke to the Bishop of Oxford, Dr. Stephen Croft, and he had a lot to say about gay marriage, same-sex marriage in the church, and his views obviously were something that was picked up across the university, but also he spoke about the relevance of the church today and its responsibilities in Oxford. And those are the sorts of people we want to have on this show. And we've got another individual today who's come into the studio who has perhaps even more different experiences than the Bishop of Oxford, and that is the Librarian of the Bodleian, Mr. Richard Ovenden. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Theo. Thank you for inviting me on the show.
Well, it's actually a pleasure to have you on here, because we were saying before we started recording, we weren't actually sure when we were sort of preparing this interview, you know, what's the best line you can take with Librarian of the Bodleian? Because we all know the Bodleian. We all know the librarians who tell us off and fine you or whatever.
We'll get onto that.
But, you know, with all respect, what, you know, do you grow up wanting to be a librarian then? Do you grow up liking books? Or, you know, how does this all happen for you?
So I had no idea that there was even a job to be a librarian, I think probably until I went to university myself. Although I'd used the public library in my hometown in Deal in Kent a lot, and almost kind of without thinking that there was an organisation behind all these free books that I could go in and borrow. And then I discovered a second-hand bookshop when I was at school, and by chance I discovered a history textbook that my history master at school was using to plagiarise his lessons from.
Oh, wow.
And I discovered that books are actually quite useful because I could stay ahead of his lessons by looking at this book. And also, I would lip sync along with him because he was plagiarising it so closely, much to the amusement of my friends in the class. And so I sort of thought, actually, books and bookshops and libraries are quite useful, quite interesting places. And then when I went to university, I became a student librarian in my college, which was, I went to Durham, actually.
Mm.
And I got a job over the summer vac one year, moving what was called the secondary sequence, which was basically a basement full of dusty old books, to make room to enlarge the college bar.
Mm.
And I got paid for doing it, which I thought, oh, this is quite good. And I discovered some really old books that I thought, well, these look important or interesting. So I went to the university library and asked for some advice. And I got introduced to a person called the Keeper of Rare Books. And she had a sort of brass plaque on her door that said that. And I thought, this is really cool. It'd be fantastic to have. And so that's how I really got involved in the world of libraries. And I stayed on after I graduated as a graduate trainee librarian in the University Library at Durham, and then, you know, just became completely absorbed in the whole thing. But actually, I wanted to be a photographer when I was 16.
Mm.
And my school, which was a kind of a state grammar school, but it didn't think that that was something that their boys, because it was an all-boys school, mm. did. So they kind of practically beat it out of me.
So what is it like then when you say you had that interest in university in Durham?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I've had enough of libraries already in my second year here. But like, how is it then that, you know, how did your sort of friends sort of react to you? Because, you know, it's obviously, if you say, for example, you want to be a doctor or you want to you want to work in the city, it's sort of an accepted thing. But if you say you want to be a librarian, and
yes.
you know, what was the reaction to that? Because it's sort of a very niche thing to do when you're particularly a teenager, maybe.
Yeah, it is. I think my interests have always been, well, certainly at that time, towards the kind of rare books end of things. So research collections. And I did a history degree, and one of the courses I did on the Counter-Reformation, they actually took us into rare books in Durham University Library, and we had a course on censorship in the Renaissance, and they showed us original copies of the Index, you know, the Index Librorum Prohibitorum. And actually seeing this thing, you know, that you read all these articles about and actually then holding one in your hands was quite a kind of powerful experience for me. And so then when I was a trainee, some of my friends were staying on. They were either doing languages, and so they were there for a fourth year, or they were doing masters or something. And, you know, I was showing them some of these kind of, you know, rare books and manuscripts that I was handling. And they were, oh, this is really cool. God, yeah. You know, so it's there is a kind of stereotype of libraries, which unfortunately is wrong and but persistent. And the world of libraries is so interesting, so dynamic. It changes all the time. And in a big library like the Bodleian, where there's a huge variety of roles, you know, we can accommodate almost every type of interest, actually, from kind of, you know, commercial to, you know, high-end research, lots of digital in between. It's a service industry, it's also a research institution, and, you know, our mission really is to preserve knowledge and to share it with as many people as possible and to pass information down from one generation to the next. And that's part of what it means to be in an open society, is having access to knowledge for our citizens. So that's an important role that we play.
And you're the 25th person to hold the title, if Wikipedia serves me correct.
It does.
Yeah, and we'll go on to, you know, all the things you do, because there's actually a lot of sort of news stories out there, because the Bodleian is obviously the second biggest library in Britain, behind the British Library. But just on being a librarian then, because I was researching what you've done. As you say, you're in Durham University's library, then you're in the House of Lords Library, the National Library of Scotland, University of Edinburgh, and then obviously before you were the librarian of the BOD, you were still working there anyway.
Yeah.
So what's it been like in terms of actually working in a library? Because you said, you just touched upon the role of a library and what it's like. How has the sort of concept of a library changed, perhaps, since you were first sort of official librarian back in 1985, I think it was?
Yes, so absolutely.
So how's that changed? How's it?
It's changed a lot. There are certain kind of fundamental aspects that are the same. So we, you know, libraries still hold collections, and they make them available to readers, to users. But in the course of doing that sort of core function, a lot has changed. So the digital revolution has happened. So when I became a graduate trainee in 1985, there was one PC which practically the whole of the lights of the city of Durham dimmed when you turned it on. And it was kind of amazingly powerful, we thought at the time. And, you know, my phone has probably 100 or 1,000 times the power now. And so the whole acquisition of content in digital form, the licensing, the shift from purchasing materials to licensing them from publishers, the way that readers interact with knowledge, searching for them online, that's changed a lot. And also I think there's also been a kind of shift in the culture of libraries from being that stereotypical sort of protective, actually readers are quite a nuisance because what we want to do is kind of, you know, protect the books that we have, to actually being allowing people to use them more, to being more open about knowledge and things like the role of things like exhibitions. So in the Bodleian we have our new-ish Western Library with its exhibition spaces, and putting on events to open up to the general public, not just to the academic community. And that whole sort of role that university libraries have as being more than just a university kind of service industry is quite an interesting change.
And obviously, if you have a look back, your predecessors were Sarah Thomas as a librarian at the Bodleian.
Yeah.
She was sort of criticised to some extent when sort of the staff had like those Ask Me t-shirts and those yellow. Do you think, for example, when you look at things like that, is that something that perhaps pushes the boundary of a library too far? It turns into sort of a light museum sort of thing then, because you want to actually have an academic experience as well as having maybe tour guides or something like that, you know?
Yeah. I don't think so. I think, you know, there is a kind of an atmosphere, an environment for study, which libraries kind of curate those reading room experiences are important. I'm a user of libraries myself, and there's nothing more irritating than going into a reading room and finding, you know, people larking about. So, you know, I want to go into a place where I can actually concentrate hard in what we call companionable study, and basically around other people who are also concentrating hard. And so there is a balance to be struck, but I think sort of, you know, when you're doing induction for new undergraduates, putting on a welcoming face, making it obvious who the staff are so that they can be shown how to use the library, doesn't seem to be a sort of, you know, a radical gesture to me. I think it's just kind of normal.
And before, you know, we started talking about the Bodleian, you can look at, you know, what you mentioned about the digital age, and we'll talk about that in depth, because I know you're involved with projects with Google and things like that. But just in terms of when, you know, you when, so people understand the sort of chronology of it. So when you first became librarian, like the actual librarian at the Bodleian, you come into that role, probably the most famous library, or one of the most famous in the Western world generally, or definitely the most famous university library anyway. You know, since then, since you came in, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, I think it was, what's sort of been your priorities? Is it to make it that much more open, that much more accessible, that much more of an experience as well as an academic centre of learning?
I think that's certainly been part of it. So, you know, the library, the Bodleian has incredible riches. You know, we've been lucky over 400 plus years to have been given or to have acquired amazing cultural, scientific, intellectual resources. And I think not sharing them is a wasted opportunity, not only for the library, but for the university and for society as a whole. So making them more accessible, making the library easier to use, whether you're a senior scholar or a member of the public coming in to look at an exhibition, is part of what motivates me in this role. But also there's the whole issue around sustainability. So, you know, to be able to deliver the services, to acquire the collections, to perform the role that we have in Oxford requires a lot of resources. And when resources in higher education are constantly under pressure, we have to kind of diversify those income streams. So finding new ways to raise money to make the library continue what it's doing at the quality and the level that we're operating is vitally important. And for us, that's about the endowment, actually.
So, you know, on that issue of sustainability and funding then, because I know you sit on the Board of Research Libraries in the UK. And you, I think you still are on the Consortium of European Research.
I'm the treasurer. Go to Amsterdam for the board meeting at the AGM tomorrow.
So on that then, and the issue of funding, is there sort of a need to sort of diversify your income and your funding? If we have events, and this comes up in every single interview I do, is it things like Brexit? Is it does that actually affect the way you have research, the way you have books, the way you can actually get that endowment?
So yes to all of those things, but just to sort of tease the issues out a bit. So on income generally, the university provides us with just over 70% of our funding. So, you know, 27-28% of it comes from other sources. So partly that's our endowment, partly that's philanthropy, partly it's special grants, research grants, or special funding we have directly from the government, and partly it's our commercial income. So from the cafes, from our shops, from the publishing operation. So they all generate a surplus which gets ploughed back into keeping the reading rooms open, buying more books, doing those kinds of functions. And so having that range of income streams gives us better a better balance in where our money's coming from in case there are changes. The university is constantly under pressure for its own finances, and so we need to protect ourselves from the changes in, you know, the structure of, you know, government funding, research funding. Brexit is part of that. The initial impact of Brexit has been on the decline of the value of sterling. So we buy lots of books and journals and databases in dollars and euros and other currencies. They've suddenly become more expensive. So last year it was about £250,000 more we had to spend on those licenses and subscriptions just to stand still. So they are posing significant challenges, and you know, who knows whether we'll be able to join European research projects, which also provide us with income in order to catalogue books, do digitisation, collaborate with our research partners around Europe. So it definitely makes it harder. And then underneath it all, we have you know, fantastic staff in the library, many of whom are European citizens, and they're concerned about whether they can stay in the country. You know, all of those issues, which are perfectly natural concerns to have. And we're lucky to have really highly qualified, talented staff, very, very committed. They come from all over the world, and we need to keep that balance of talent wherever their nationality is.
I suppose it's difficult as well, because obviously I think in the Bodleian's about 32 libraries, isn't it?
Well, 29 now.
29, oh, yeah. There we go. See, this is my poor research coming out in the middle of the interview. But with those sort of 29 libraries then, you can give me the benefit of the doubt.
okay.
How do you sort of balance the sort of resources that go to each one? And if you look at sort of, I know there's sort of a bit of a revamp of the humanities libraries, you know, with your predecessor again. How do you sort of distribute the sort of funding, but also the resources, the staff, you know, the actual buildings themselves? How do you keep them up? You know, how do you make the decisions yourself, or with the team or whatever?
So we have a senior management organisation. So we have a subject-based approach to our library provision. So we have an organisation which mirrors the academic structure of the university. So there are, you know, the five academic divisions, and we have a library management structure that maps onto those, and they vary in the number of sort of specialist libraries in each of their areas. So, you know, medicine, there are four libraries. Science now really only has two. And that's partly a factor of kind of history. There's a complicated backstory to it, but you know, the library system in Oxford has kind of evolved over the years, and the Bodleian became responsible for all or most of the centrally funded libraries in the university in 2000, and we've been sort of evolving that structure ever since. Some of that has been library mergers to move them in smaller libraries into bigger libraries so that we can keep the opening hours as long as possible. Just make it more efficient to run. And so we respond and talk to the academic divisions very closely about how their services are, you know, directed. You know, the opening hours, the amount of, you know, what collections we need to buy, what are the subjects or research areas that they need to adapt, what kind of digital tools do we need to put in place.
And perhaps then, touching upon what you just said before as well, in terms of how we can get income into these libraries, does it actually cause you perhaps some concern, or it's a difficult issue to consider that libraries and museums, and when Czar Sturgis was here, director of the Ashmolean, he was saying that, you know, of course it's great that we have the cafe and the restaurant in the Ashmolean, but perhaps sometimes that could take away from the actual experience and the purpose of actually what the museum and the place is. Is that something you could say, that perhaps the future of public institutions like libraries and museums, that something is a difficult thing to consider?
Is it a difficult thing to consider? I think the difficulty is getting the balance right. So the challenge, we have to do it, otherwise we won't survive as institutions. Culture, learning, you know, all of those things will ultimately fail unless we get the income right, unless we're able to put these institutions on a sustainable footing over the long term. And so, but the real challenge, the real skill that we all need to get is the balance between those different sources of income, between commercial activity, philanthropy, and actually the core sort of academic and intellectual purpose. And that's something which I did the diploma in library archive and information science and at UCL, and we didn't get taught anything about this kind of thing. And so I hope that the equivalent training courses are actually helping you know, the librarians of the future to understand those issues. You know, I didn't think I'd be running you know, a group of businesses, we call them Bodleian enterprises within the Bodleian, that have a turnover of £4 million a year. You know, they're not trivial businesses. They employ a lot of people and they deliver almost £1 million of surplus back to the bottom line of the library so that we can continue to buy books, keep the reading rooms open, employ specialist staff, all of those kind of things.
So do you get students actually coming into the Bodleian and actually sort of training to be librarians then?
Yeah, absolutely. We have student interns. We've had undergraduates in Oxford do one of our internship or special projects and then go on into the profession. Or some of them have gone into other parts of academia. But, an important part of what we do is to think about the future of our own profession. And so we have a number of programs which are focused at graduate trainees. We have a thing called Skills for the Future, which is about digital archives. But we also work with local schools. So we've had school groups come in to look at the range of different careers, job opportunities that you might get. Mm. And you wouldn't necessarily think of a library as providing those.
And if you look then, perhaps another issue that students will face with libraries maybe is actually fines. I can say that I've never been fined ever in my time here in Oxford.
I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah, and you know, maybe I scribble a bit on the book, but not too much. Don't tell a secret anyway. Okay. But I was reading through the sort of the research online that's been done, and there was actually a freedom of information request that was accepted, revealing that there was about £92,254.70 in university library fines for overdue items in 2015-2016.
Yeah,
which is you think it's an absolutely astronomical sum, but so the release that the Bodleian gave, that doesn't actually translate then into a lot of money per person if you think about it, because I think the fines are about 10p or something like that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But generally on sort of fines and that sort of astronomical figure,
is there
another way that we can make sure people actually behave and actually conduct themselves in a way which is better?
Absolutely. It's called bringing your books back or renewing them online. It's not that difficult, Theo, honestly. Yeah. So we've actually made it in the course of, since I've been responsible for the library, easier to return, to renew your books online. You get an email reminding you.
I do all the time, every single time.
You go into your own account in Solo and you click renew all. It's really not that hard. And there's absolutely no reason why anyone should incur a fine at all.
Is it frustrating though? Because 92,000 is a lot of it's a lot of money.
Absolutely, it is. We'd rather not get any of that money.
Mm.
We'd rather, because what happens when you don't renew a book is that you prevent someone else from accessing that information. And you know, we know that we're lucky in Oxford because there are a lot of books, there are a lot of libraries. Obviously, the 38 college libraries, so the provision is excellent, but it's uneven. And, you know, some of the materials that students need to access are scarce. And if you hog it, you're preventing someone else from actually being able to write their essay or, you know, do the research that they need to do for their course. Mm. And so it's an antisocial act.
Oh, there we go. Is that serious? Okay.
It's not antisocial for us. You should feel, as students, that it's antisocial within your own community.
Mm.
And honestly, it is really easy to renew books online. We've made it even easier. Actually, the amount of money that we get through fines has dropped considerably since in the 14 years that I've been at the Bodleian. So the figures going back even further into the early years of this century... sounds like years ago, doesn't it? Was Probably 3 or 4 times that number.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Because it was actually there wasn't the online facility to do the renewals. So now there is, and the amount of fine income has dropped considerably. But if you actually look at the figures, it's there are a number of repeat offenders. So actual number of people who are incurring the fines is far fewer than the total number of fines. So it's not, you know, one person per fine.
Yeah.
It's one person per 5 or 6 fines, typically.
Just terrible people, aren't they?
So it's just people who are perhaps over-concentrating on their work and just could spend just a few seconds.
Well, that's why I'm guilty, probably. That's because I'm so focused on the work.
You just get caught up in it, don't you? Yeah.
But you'd mentioned, we've been mentioning sort of the online and sort of the digital throughout this interview, and you know, you said how it's made it easier, really, to actually renew books, which is one aspect of it.
Yeah.
But for those people that don't know, you are heavily involved in actually making sure that libraries and literature is available online. Because I said you were involved with the Google project, which is about digitalising copies and things like that. And are you still the president of the Digital Preservation
Coalition? I am indeed.
So you're involved, really, in sort of maybe, I could say, the future of literature and future of books and museums. What do you think, then, of the situation we're in now? Because I know you summarised it at the start, but do we sort of stay with books and libraries? Because there's actually been a decline in e-book use over the last few years and few months. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what's the situation we're in now?
It's very interesting, actually, because the death of the book has been foretold for about 50 or 60 years. And it is managed to survive as a technology, the kind of traditional codex form, we call it, of the printed book, has been around since Gutenberg invented movable type in the West, so that's 1450-ish. And the codex form itself goes back to the 1st or 2nd century AD, so it's been around for getting on for 2,000 years. As a technology, it's actually extremely effective. And what has happened, the digital revolution has challenged that format and provided, you know, the ability to search every single word and to do other kinds of scholarship around books and for books to be available 24/7 wherever you are, as long as you have an internet connection and power. And so that's transformed the way that we use information. And certainly when e-books came along, we saw a decline in the amount of print being sold and consumed. But what happened is that publishers responded to the challenge by going back to the core aspects of what a codex is, what a book form is. So looking at the design, the look and feel, the paper, the typography, illustrations, the physicality of the book. And you find books now are produced much more attractively than they used to before. They look nicer, they're cooler, and they've responded by batting away some of that market share that e-books were taking away from them. So the e-book has kind of plateaued at sort of between 18 and 20% of the trade. The physical book has responded really well. Certain areas of it, it's actually growing, and digital technology is making it easier to produce print books. You see that in kind of niche magazines, fashion magazines, design magazines. They're the cool thing. You go into certain news agents in the edgier parts of London, you find them kind of stacked high on the floor with magazines, very expensive magazines, very kind of glossy, with no title on them. You know, if you don't know what they're called, you're not cool enough.
Yeah, well, you say that in terms of like the e-books, and I think it was about £240 million, I think, e-books were sold, worth of e-books sold, and there was about 360 million of books in 2016, actual books, which is a clear difference since about 2011 when the Kindle sort of came into play. But if you look at then the difference in terms of actual literature we have out there, because we've seen, yes, the books are surviving, they're looking better, but then perhaps if you look at sort of newspapers, there has been a decline. So why do you think that is then specifically, that books and not newspapers are not, you know, there's a different sort of standard or sort of situation they have?
I think you've got to distinguish different kinds of information or different kinds of knowledge. So long form reading is still something which human beings prefer to do in physical form, generally. Yeah. But news is becoming disaggregated into smaller and smaller chunks, and it's easier to deliver those by, particularly by social media. And so social media is replacing, you know, the traditional news platforms, I think. I think that's what's happening. And because that tends to be free, people are abandoning their paid-for news, which I think is actually... a serious threat to an open society.
So you look at, well, on that threat we have then, you know, you've been working with Google on their mass digitization project. Do you look at those threats then specifically as well in the digital age, and perhaps not only the challenges to news and sort of, you know, whatever, but do you look at how we can perhaps utilize technology? Because I know of Solo, for example, you know, the access... You know, I love seeing an online resource there, you know, because you don't have to leave, you just put it up on a laptop. But you have to look at some of the dangers as well, and that we perhaps lose sort of the academic rigor, the access, the tradition, you know, the academia. You know, what's the dangers?
I think there are, so a lot of it is, we have a phrase called provenance. So, you know, where does the information come from? How can you be sure that it's accurate, that it's kind of verifiable? And so having a point of reference that is a trusted source is something that we need to, you know, train our young and old researchers in being aware of those challenges. And so I think whatever format the information is delivered in, the role of libraries and archives too is to sort of curate that knowledge. So through things like catalogue interfaces like Solo, so that you can be sure that the information in there is verifiable, so that when you cite something, it will be there when you when someone else goes to check your research, whether that's your supervisor or tutor, or whether it's somebody marking your dissertation or an editor of a journal, you know, checking your... footnotes in your article, or going to the research data. So we have a research data repository for our researchers to put their data into an open and shareable form, so that we know that other researchers around the world can go in and, you know, do their own research or verify the results that you've drawn from your own research. And so the with the multiplicity of, you know, you can get information from all sorts of places online now. But, you know, actually, is it accurate?
Yeah.
Is it verifiable? Can you actually cite it and know that you can go, or someone else can go and check that research independently? And that's part of the reason why we have been working with the Wikimedia Foundation to employ a Wikimedian in residence who's both improving the quality of articles in Wikipedia that relate to the university, but also training other people inside Oxford to do that editing, so that we all work together to make some of these open resources like Wikipedia a much higher quality.
And do you think then hypothetically that there will come a stage in the next, you know, 100, 200 years when we're both gone and everything's moved on? They could, you know, something could happen in between, but whatever.
Yeah.
Will we see an eventual decline then of books, or we will see that ebook increase again, like we've seen with newspapers and things like that? Or...
So there's no question that the volume of digital information is growing exponentially all the time. So some of that is actually information that we don't normally see. A lot of that is the traffic of our online behaviour that happens sort of in the wires behind the scenes. Some of it is information that comes off, you know, experimental science instruments, telescopes, or other forms of scientific instrumentation. But the information that we kind of read online, journal articles, newspapers, books, that is still going to happen in a hybrid form. I'm absolutely convinced. The book as a form of technology is so successful, it's defied the challenge of radio, the cinema, the telephone, the internet. I'm sure it's going to persist into the foreseeable future.
And you've also published work, and you said you wanted to be a photographer when you were younger. You still sort of published work based on that interest you have in sort of academic research.
Yeah, absolutely.
What about photography then, books, you know, and you know, digital articles then? Is photography still a key aspect of research, academic work, and, you know, citing sources? Is that something that's still got a foreseeable future, like books?
Yeah, completely. So photography has moved heavily into the digital world. But I was at a conference in Bristol on Saturday of British contemporary photographers, and they still regard the physical book as the primary means of sharing their work.
Not social media or websites?
They use Instagram. They use all of them. But actually, the thing that they want is a high-quality, beautifully produced, printed book. So, you know, the coolest young photographers, that's what they want their work to be seen in. And so there is a concept called the photo book, which is an absolutely amazing phenomenon of our time. Mm. And it's showing the kind of the power, the creativity that goes into the design and the look and the way that those books work as objects works incredibly well with the photographic image. And so I don't think that's going away, you know, particularly in an age where we're surrounded, we're saturated by the photographic image digitally. I mean, I take hundreds of them on my phone every day.
Yeah.
You can see billions of them being shared on Facebook every single day. But how do you distinguish your work as an artist or a documentary photographer in all of that mass? Actually printing a book, even though it might only have a run of 200, 400, 500, that's the way that you mark yourself out, because it's a way of getting your work noticed. It's a mark of your quality, your own commitment to the medium.
And you could perhaps argue as well that it's for the Bodleian, as you do, to actually hold these sorts of exhibitions, not only having authors in, because I know you've had you know, some great authors in recently displaying their work, but you've had also artists coming in as well, and particularly with the new sort of new Bodleian and the West Library and everything. Yeah. So would you say perhaps it's a collaboration again between libraries, books, and photography? And
absolutely. I mean, I think there always has been. I mean, if you look at the nomenclature of photography, you talk about a photographic print, or you talk about printing your photographs out. You know, it's the same aspect of you know, sharing knowledge that the publishing and printing industries were so successful, have been so successful at. And you know, the inventor of photography, William Henry Fox Talbot, whose archive we have in the Bodleian, you know, that was one of the things that he wanted most to do, was to make it possible for more people to share the, you know, visual information through the medium of the book. He actually patented the sharing of photography in print, but he released the patent. He opened it up in 1851 when a book was published of photographs of the 1851 Great Exhibition. He wanted as many people as possible to see these photographs and to see the amazing things that happened in that sort of incredible exhibition in London. And so he made it possible for other people, other publishers, freely to use that technology.
Mm, and perhaps one of the most interesting things in the Bodleian now has is actually a printer in residence.
Yes,
right? I am right.
Richard Lawrence. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, what is a printer in residence then? Because I just genuinely don't know. Like, what you do?
So a number of years ago, we acquired some historic printing presses from the 19th century, which we used staff and faculty members in the English faculty to teach students, both undergraduates and graduate students, how books were made before the mass production of books in the hand, what we call the hand press era, where books were really kind of handcrafted things. And so we had those printing presses and those type. They were buried for many, many years in the bowels of what was the new Bodleian Library, relatively inaccessible. When we had to do the big renovation project, which created the Western Library, we actually moved them to a more accessible location in the old school's quadrangle of the old Bod. And we, through some philanthropy, were able to hire a printer in residence and to actually open that function up, not just to students, but to the public as well on occasion. So we still do all of those practical hand press classes with students and graduate students, but we also have members of the public and school groups come in to learn to print themselves and to learn how books were made. We have one of the presses in the Western Library on a Saturday afternoon. Anyone can go up and actually see it. I actually showed it to the Singaporean Minister of Communication, you know, one of the most high-tech city-states on the planet, and he was delighted to you know, pull the lever and ink the type up, and he took away his little keepsake and very excited. It's like a little boy again, you know.
So that's sort of like sort of an actual sort of physical engagement then in the library, because you see that in the Ashmolean where you've got a you go into the Ashmolean and you can actually sort of lift these sort of objects up and use like hammers and other things, right? Yeah. So that's sort of a way of actually getting people in as
it
well.
It is, absolutely, yeah. So, you know, we do it with kind of digital interactives, obviously, for members of the public to come and learn more about those exhibitions. But you also got the kind of the physicality of the book and, you know, there or bookmaking. And the printing, you know, we've got a number of historic printing presses now. It's a very kind of vibrant little print studio. We actually have a guest printer, a famous American bookmaker called Russell Marray here at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, fantastic to have him in our community. And, you know, being able to interact with artists and bookmakers who are still have that interest in the physical form of the book is actually, I think, one of the things that we are able to do as a library, and particularly a kind of library that the Bodleian is, and partly because we have a great tradition of that. So when William Morris was an undergraduate in the middle of the 19th century, he came into the Bodleian and saw medieval manuscripts for the first time. And it kind of literally blew his mind and sort of changed the way kind of aesthetics of design, you know, not just in bookmaking, but in curtain fabrics and stained glass and all sorts of things. You go into the, you know, the Oxford Union Library or Exeter College Chapel or, you know, various places. You can see the impact of that moment coming into the Bod had on someone like William Morris.
So I suppose, you know, for the last 5-10 minutes of this interview then, just talking about what the Bodleian wants to achieve and, you know, what you see as the role of the Bodleian in the next 10, 15 years. Do you think then that the Bodleian should be working more with other libraries across the country, maybe because of, you know, we've talked about Brexit, we've talked about the financial difficulties, we've talked about the digital age. Is that the way forward, or is it forming an independent voice and leading the way yourselves?
So I think it's a bit of both, actually. I mean, we are still an independent institution. We have our historic collections that we continue to build up. And I think, you know, we need to continue doing that, both for the sake of our own academic community here in Oxford, but also as our role for the international community of scholars. But we also collaborate very extensively, both in the UK and across the world. So we're a legal deposit library. We get free books published in the UK and the Republic of Ireland. We work very closely with the other legal deposit libraries, British Library, Cambridge University, National Libraries of Scotland and Wales, and Trinity Dublin. But we also have very close relationships with, say, the Deutsche Literaturarchiv in Marbach, the German Literary Archive, with the New York Public Library, with the National Library of Singapore, with the National Library of China, a number of other major you know, research libraries around the world. But I think there's also a role that I'd like to see us play more in supporting perhaps public libraries in the UK, where we can work together with them, perhaps just at sharing skills and knowledge. But also, I think it can play a role in helping to see the fact that no one library can do it all anymore.
Yeah.
Particularly with the complexity of the digital world. That's why I'm involved in the Digital Preservation Coalition, because we need to share the responsibility of stewarding knowledge and being able to pass that from one generation to the next.
Mm.
You know, the Bodleian absolutely is a leading institution. We continue to innovate. We continue to do research. But we can't do it alone. We have to work with others.
And surely then it's difficult for you to work with these public and local libraries, even if they're actually closing down, because there's been a lot of cuts to the local institutions. And I suppose it's hard for you to actually have an influence sometimes when it's actual central government or local authorities that are making the decisions.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And so some of what we can do is kind of advocate for the role that public libraries have for society. That's something, you know, I did an interview with Philip Pullman at the launch of his book last week, and he was something he's incredibly eloquent and very vocal about. So, you know, very happy to play a role in advocating for the power and importance of public library, particularly in disadvantaged communities. But that, I think there are other ways that I'm keen to explore of ways that we can work with them. So one small way is through a thing called the David Vasey Prize. So one of my predecessors as Bodleys librarian, David Vasey, much beloved here in Oxford, but was born in Gloucestershire, and some of his friends have clubbed together to create a fund called the David Vasey Prize, which is to support innovation in the public library services in the county of Gloucestershire. That was launched at the Cheltenham Literary Festival this year. And, you know, part of the what the winner gets is to come and work with us here in Oxford, to come and, you know, exchange knowledge between those two libraries, even, you know, very small community-based services. I think it's the Bree Community Library won the David Vasey Prize, and to come and see how we can help them in the board.
And we've covered an astronomical amount of information in this interview. But if you could sum up the Bodleian Library in three words, what would it be?
Knowledge, preservation, and sharing.
It's inspiring, isn't it? Richard Ovenden, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much indeed.
I know who I'll be sending an email to when I do have an overdue book. Richard has told me beforehand that if I've got any problems, he's the guy to speak to. Sorry, you might be getting loads of emails now. I'm only joking. But no, thank you again, Richard, for coming on the show. I'm sure that most of our listeners have been to the Bodleian and have sort of tried to navigate their way through. And I have been lost many times in the Bodleian, but I can't complain. There's better places to be lost. Well, there's not many. But no, that's all we've got time for this week. We've got a few guests coming in the meantime after this pre-recorded interview, so I'm not sure, actually, who we're going to put up first. So there's a lot of people coming in over the next few weeks on Oxford Today. This evening, you'll have more shows. After me, you'll have Casper Jacobs and Ollie Brady with their music shows, which will probably be a relaxing part of your evening, because I'm sure that books don't always put you to sleep. I personally am a big fan of making sure that we keep this literature and we preserve the Bodleian, as Richard has said. But for everyone here at Oxford Today and Oxide Radio, goodbye.
Oxide Radio, online and on demand. Listen back to all your favourite shows on oxideradio.live.